another bombshell out of the White House. This time, it's the president's son. Donald Trump Jr. admits that he met with a Russian attorney a few weeks before the Republican convention. How much trouble is Donald Trump Jr. in? We discuss. Back in Wisconsin, there is still no state budget, and the battle lines between the factions of the Republican Party seem as wide as ever. And in Milwaukee, there's an effort by the Common Council to control the hiring and firing of the police chief. What's behind this effort? We discuss. All that and more today from the best political team in Wisconsin on Politics. Well, good afternoon, everybody. I'm David Haynes. I'm the opinions editor at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And big news out of Washington once again this week involving Donald Trump and his family, this time Donald Trump Jr. I'm joined by Dan Bice, columnist for the Journal Sentinel, and Bill Glauber, a reporter. Bill, lots of news, lots of emails flying around about this meeting that Trump Jr. had with a Russian lawyer about a year ago. How much trouble might he be in?
First of all, I think he is in trouble. I think that the father's in trouble because they had been denying for a year that there were any contacts between them and the Russians, and now there's this first contact, which is in an email and then in a meeting. Whether it's legal or not, have no idea. Seems to be a tip of the iceberg thing. You know, he campaigned here. Unlike Hillary Clinton, Donald Jr. actually campaigned here. Interviewed him. You know, an impressive guy, and he could hold the crowd, the audience. It was in Brookfield. He was a good surrogate for his father.
But he did a fundraiser here, too.
Yes, he did. But this is beyond surrogacy. You know, this is quite serious. He got somehow mixed up in the actual campaign workings, and you know, it's unlike any campaign we've ever heard of. You know operatives, Dan, and if they get something like this, you know, if the top people in the campaign get something like this, they pick up a phone and say, whoa.
But it's actually a lack of experience that allowed this to happen because in addition to the information that you get, you want to see who it's coming from, whether they have an axe to grind, that sort of stuff. But let me play devil's advocate here. I've been listening to Rush Limbaugh, Sean Hannity, and Fox News for the last couple days.
Your ears are burning.
I had to do it as part of my job. They have several arguments against this, not saying this isn't a huge story. The first one is that there's nothing illegal here. They're quoting everybody from Alan Dershowitz to Jeffrey Toobin saying, just keep on moving, nothing big here. What do you think?
On the face of it, they're probably, right now, you have some people saying something illegal has occurred, but I would go on the side of caution and say we really don't know what occurred. Because we don't even know. We're taking their explanation, the lawyer and Donald Trump Jr. basically saying nothing happened here, but we really don't know what happened.
What about the argument that Trump didn't know any of this stuff? That he had no idea that this meeting occurred, so he's pretty much inoculated.
Donald Trump, the president, not
right.
The junior.
Do you believe that? I mean, he loves gossip. This would be the ultimate gossip.
And then finally, a big argument is that no information was exchanged. They had this meeting, and you had two different interviews. You had Donald Trump Jr.'s explanation and the Russian attorney's explanation. They're pretty similar, and essentially, the biggest part of the discussion was about adoptions from Russian kids.
Yeah, and there's some people who say this is sort of an opening salvo. This is how you reel somebody in. You see if they take the meeting. We don't know all the facts. Donald Trump Jr. may be called to testify before Congress.
He's going to be.
And that should be interesting. And, you know, I subscribe to the John McCain theory of all this. Whenever they capture John McCain in the hallway, he's always saying, well, another shoe is going to drop, so I'm going to basically...
From the centipede,
So I would basically say another shoe is going to drop.
On the experience question, Donald Jr. clearly is not an experienced political operative, but Paul Manafort, who also was at the meeting, is.
Yeah, but Paul Manafort is he's more of an influence peddler than he is a campaign operative, and in fact, he has described himself as an influence peddler and agrees that that's the case, that he occasionally has a role with a campaign and then he sells his access to that when they get in. He's probably not the best person you want to be, you want to have discussing the ethics of whether you should be meeting or not meeting.
Especially when you're dealing with Russia or former states of the Soviet Union.
And it turns out
he has a lot of dealings.
He's done some work within Ukraine.
Right. And so that's, I mean, that's the other issue, because he apparently has a stake in this too. So just thinking about the Trump campaign, if you have a serious ethical issue like this, Donald Trump Jr. gets this, who in the campaign does he turn to say, is this a good thing for us to meet with them or not a good thing? And I have a hard time thinking of who that individual might be.
Well, let me ask you about somebody else. Dan, let me ask you this. The Washington Post reported this week that Reince Priebus is being held responsible for the lack of discipline in the White House, including this sort of thing. And Ivanka, Jared Kushner, and Melania Trump have all been pushing Trump to fire Priebus, even though they've released statements.
Who do you replace him with? I mean, first of all, who is there that's on the bench? I mean, you have somebody who, I mean, the chief of staff has to keep the trains running on time and is as much a manager as they are an idea person. I mean, you have that issue. And then, two, who would want the job? I think that's another serious issue.
You know, I saw Reince last month. He came through here, you know, on the trip where Trump
had the fundraiser
at the Hyatt, Mitchell Airport. And you know, Reince told me, you know, those stories about me being forced out, they're not true, basically.
But, you know, there were the stories Politico reported last month that he was likely to be out by July 4th. July 4th has come and gone. You know, he's in a pretty terrible situation trying to explain and justify, trying to promote an agenda that has enough problems on its own while at the same time managing the sideshow, which is all about this Russia.
I mean, and Trump hadn't even appeared in public, I think, until yesterday over about two-three-day period.
Yeah, 3 days.
Now he's in France. So, you know, you get a sense of the White House in utter turmoil. And then, you know, the other thing about, you know, not seeing things, you don't even see a daily press briefing anymore. It's on audio. The whole thing is strange. I mean, I think people need to sort of back up and realize this is all very strange, very unusual, very unlike modern 21st century American politics.
But frequently when there's a major controversy, politicians do go in the bunker. That's not completely unheard of. Maybe not so much at the national level, but you get it with members of Congress. When they have problems, everything goes silent, or at least pretty quiet. The only problem is when you're in the bunker, you start pointing fingers at the other people in the bunker too and start blaming them, which is probably what you...
And that seems to be some of what's happening here. And I think the rap on Priebus from at least some of the White House is he hasn't brought discipline to the White House, but could anyone bring discipline to a Trump White House?
You have to... my first dealings with Donald Trump were many, many years ago in boxing when he was, you know, having fights in New Jersey. And I view... I view Donald Trump through the prism of professional boxing. Nothing has changed. And that, you know, he was the impresario of these fights. They were crazy, wild events. And nothing that's happened ever since has led me to believe that anything other than he's operating the White House like he might operate a boxing
match. Well, you know, he ran and he won as a non-political person. I'm a businessman, an outsider who wants to come to this position. We need someone who's not a politician. There are strengths to that. And then there are certainly the weaknesses, and the weaknesses are front and center right now.
Yeah. All right. Well, we need to move on to a more local topic. This week, the Common Council in Milwaukee, at least some members of the council, decided that they should have more control over the hiring and firing of the police chief. We talked to Ashley Lutheran and Mary Spacuzza, two reporters who have been covering that. So now I'm joined by Ashley Lutheran, a reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and Mary Spacuzza, another reporter. Ashley, let me start with you. The Common Council in Milwaukee basically threw a fit this week regarding the police chief. What's going on there?
They did. There was some discussion of what to do with civil asset forfeiture, money that the police seize during investigations, typically has been drug investigations. And that sort of devolved into a debate on the council floor about the performance of Chief Flynn, the direction of the department, and council's ability or lack of ability to be involved with the hiring or firing of the city police chief.
Right. And for a long time, that's been the sole province, right, of the Fire and Police Commission.
That's correct. Under state law, the Milwaukee Fire and Police Commission is tasked with appointing the fire and police chiefs. and that was developed to protect it from a political process many, many, many years ago, and it's in state statute, so this would require a change to state law.
Mm-hmm. So, Mary, talk a little bit about the politics here. There seems to be a majority, right, on the council that wants to do this?
A number of them. I don't know if I would say it was a majority. There were some that seemed to be supportive that were a bit on the fence. Some okay. wanted to see more because it really was kind of surprisingly unveiled. It was not on the agenda. But when they were talking about asset forfeiture and Alderman Russell Stamper started speaking out against it, he was actually shocked that they weren't burning drug money and thought that that was the policy, which I don't know when that was ever the policy in Milwaukee, but it's typically used for law enforcement purposes, public safety. But he then voiced frustration about Flynn, how Flynn spends it and not having to get council approval of how it's being spent. That, you know, as Ashley said, devolved into a wider discussion about Flynn. But I think that there is a lot of frustration from the council that they feel like they hear a lot from their constituents with concerns about public safety. Obviously, there have been concerns about carjacking, concerns about driving and some, you know, high-speed chases, and that they feel like they're held accountable to, you know, by their constituents, but that they can't hold the police chief accountable in a way that they want to. And they feel, I think there's frustration that they feel like either the Fire and Police Commission or the mayor have too much power and where's their say in everything.
Actually, how has Chief Flynn reacted to that upheaval yesterday?
So the chief so far has declined to comment. I know he's mostly stayed above the fray when there was some discussion and a little bit of controversy related to his reappointment to his third term in the summer of 2015, I believe. You know, he basically said he would be honored to have the job. He, you know, was happy as police chief at that time. So I'm not sure how he's currently reacting.
We're not sure if he's still happy or how happy.
Right.
How about Mayor Barrett? What's Mayor Barrett said?
Mayor Barrett said he would fight this, that this is a change that would take power away from a citizen board, and seems to feel like nothing should change and it should stay with the Fire and Police Commission. Another opponent of the change, Alderman Terry Witkowski, said that he felt this would politicize the process and essentially make it hard to recruit talent, to keep talent, if suddenly they have 15 additional bosses, the number of common council members. And so he was very opposed to it. Mayor Barrett was as well.
Something also notable, Alderman Bob Donovan, who obviously ran against Mayor Tom Barrett in the last mayoral election, he also is not in favor of this proposal, at least right now. That's what he told us. He, too, has said he's not he said he's been, quote, disappointed with the chief, but he did not support this measure.
It's interesting because he's been a very vocal opponent of the chief for months, if not years.
So where does this go from here? There's a legislative effort now, apparently.
There is, yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
As just there's a new bill circulating for co-sponsorship, which would, I think it's a little different. I need to look at the details, but it sounds like it would give the Common Council the power to essentially, they would have to sign off on whoever is appointed police chief. I'm assuming that would go for reappointments, too. So it sounds a little different, but we're just finding out about it, so we're trying to get the details.
All right. Well, we'll keep watching it. Ashley and Mary, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And now let's talk about the state budget, or the lack of a state budget. We spoke with Jason Stein about that. Republicans are still at odds in Madison. So, Jason, the Republicans continue to be at odds in the legislature about how to finish the state budget, and transportation is one of the big hang-ups. So where are we at on that?
Well, where we're at is really nowhere so far. I mean, you see in the Assembly, Speaker Robin Voss did make the concession that he is accepting the fact that there will not be a gas tax or vehicle fee or other type of revenue increase to help pay for road projects. But he is still trying, he has fallen back to a position of, therefore, there will be no new borrowing by the state for road projects, that the state will sort of have a real base level budget. And, you know, the Senate Republicans particularly are just having, you know, none of that. They want more than $700 million in borrowing for roads. So there's almost $750 million difference that are still separating the two sides on this one.
Yeah. And wasn't there a plan thrown out there in the last few days, too, which would sort of fund transportation with revenue maybe that's being used to fund other things?
I mean, there's always that possibility. The borrowing would be, you know, whenever government borrows money, you look at what is a stream of money that's going to be used to pay off those loans. The governor once would be willing to do $300 million in loans that would be just for, you know, paid off with gas tax money, paid off with money that traditionally is used for highway projects. Senate Republicans want to toss on several hundred million dollars more that would be paid off with sales and income tax money that is typically used for schools and health care and other priorities besides roads. So that's, you know, that's one of the arguments that, you know, all that sounds pretty esoteric, but I mean, you know, at the base of it is, do you want to sort of squeeze schools a little bit in future years to have more orange cones up on the roads, you know, over the next 12 months? I mean, that's sort of what's at the heart of it.
What's the upshot of increased borrowing? Will that increase the cost of some of these road projects down the road?
Sure. I mean, you know, it's a trade-off because on the one hand, you know, because of inflation, the cost of actually doing the construction may go up, you know, probably will go up over time. They certainly have in the past. And, you know, on the other side of it is people like the Assembly Republicans are concerned that there is this ever larger share of our road fund that gets devoted to just paying off debt. You know, that a few years ago, you know, it was in the 10 cents on the dollar range. You know, now it's up, you know, past 20 cents on the dollar. You know, and they say, look, you know, you get to a certain point where that's really not sustainable, where, you know, a big chunk of your money every year just goes off to paying projects that you did in the past, and you don't have as much money to actually do things in the here and now.
So Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, whose district is in Racine County, has long been a supporter of improvements to I-94 south to the state line.
Right.
But there's been a lot of talk in recent days about the possibility of this large Asian conglomerate, Foxconn, relocating manufacturer here, and the rebuild of I-94, particularly a couple of those interchanges, plays into that as well, right?
Oh, it absolutely plays into it. I mean, the joke that I always use is that if Foxconn asked us to build I-94 with gold bricks, like, and I'm not saying we would do it, but they'd sort of take a look at it. I mean, you know, it's such a sort of generational opportunity to bring that plant to the state, and they obviously are looking at it, you know, they seem to be looking most at sites in the Racine area. And, you know, obviously, if they're going to put that sort of a multi-billion-dollar plant there, they're going to want to have a lot of assurances that they can put their, you know, flat screen TVs and their other, you know, display units onto trucks and get them onto the interstate and get them around the United States. So that's going to be a big part of the debate if that Foxconn plant materializes.
Okay, so finally, Jason, any signs of compromise here between Speaker Voss and the Senate Majority Leader or Governor Walker?
Boy, I mean, yesterday looked pretty bleak. I mean, in terms of, I really think at this point, given how long it takes to get a budget signed into law, even when you have a deal, you know, it takes a couple weeks. I think we're probably looking at August before something really gets signed. And then August gets very difficult because you have lots of vacations and so forth. The one little glimmer is, again, Speaker Voss accepting that there wouldn't be a gas tax increase. So kind of at that point, you're really sort of arguing over how much borrowing you're going to have. And that is, at the moment, it's quite an argument, but it doesn't seem like something that the two sides couldn't work out quickly if they each got the will to do that. It's just that will to compromise seems to be lacking right now.
All right, Jason Stein in Madison, thanks so much.
Oh yeah, thank you, David.
All right, so now it's time for our favorite time of the day.
Yay.
Winners and losers.
Who goes first?
Dan Bice goes first. Who's your winner?
My winner's Andy Gronick. He's the first Democrat. The Democrats now have a candidate
candidate for governor.
Running for governor, hoping to take on Scott Walker. The only question is this the candidate they want? He's not very well known. He has a little bit of money, let the public value begin.
All right, Andy Granick, and who's your loser?
My loser's the recall of Mayor Barrett drive. Just announced effort to, how many signatures do they need?
They need 52,000 signatures. Good luck with that.
My question is, didn't we just elect this guy with 70% of the vote less than a year ago? And didn't we have a couple aldermen try to run against him and Donovan and Davis? And none of that worked out very well.
Yeah. And who's behind that, do we know?
They're a couple of individuals who are front and center, but the belief is that Alderman Tony Zielinski will be the one who would be interested in running. But again, you got to get 50,000 signatures.
And then you have to beat Mayor Barrett.
Right. So it's two high hurdles that you have to do. The one thing that is going to go on, and one reason Mayor Barrett may not be so upset about this, is he gets to collect unlimited donations during this time where they're trying to collect signatures, just like Governor Walker did during his recall mm-hmm. drive. Mm-hmm. And that proved very, very important and helpful to Walker last time.
It did. Who's your loser, Bill?
Well, loser of the week, it's a rare loser, Paul Ryan. He's got a real opponent of a Democrat, Randy Bryce, this iron worker who's raised a ton of money, who's chased one person out of a potential Democratic primary, has another person. I'm not saying Randy Bryce is going to beat Paul Ryan, but he's got backing, he's got some national notoriety now, and you got an opponent that's not good. And then Dave, you wrote about Ryan having to deal with Donald Trump. You called it the Ryan shuffle. He dodges, he weaves, he loses his voice and then his nerve, and he couldn't even answer the simple question about would you take a meeting with a Russian operative who was ditching dirt on a political opponent. The answer obviously is no, but Ryan said, I'm not going to get into hypotheticals. So he's still trying to work out the dance with Donald Trump.
So is that permitted for us to start quoting the moderator?
I think in this case it is. Fine. Yes, yes.
All right. So.
Hey, I have a winner.
Oh, your winner.
I have a winner. Of course I have a winner. Milwaukee Brewers. I realize they're going to fade out of first place probably in the second half of the season, but they went through the first half of the season. A team, Dan and I talked about this. I thought this team 70 wins, max 70, 75. And, they've got 50 wins. They're building a talented core of youth. Their pitching may or may not hold up in the second half, but good for them. They've made a run.
So what's more surprising, the Brewers or the Cubs?
I think the Brewers are more surprising. I think it's never a surprise if a World Series champion takes a half step back. The Cubs are playing terrible baseball, but they made a big trade today for another starter with the White Sox. So, you expect to see them back, in the pennant chase.
And it's only a 5-game lead, so that's a week.
Yeah, it's a week. Yeah. But it's fun. Baseball in July being worthwhile in Milwaukee, who would have thought it this year?
We're usually talking Packers by this point.
Yeah. Pretty close. All right, so let's move on to a couple of reader questions. And I'm not sure who wants to take this one, but it's been reported that large media outlets, that over 90% of their articles are about Donald Trump are negative. And I keep reading, the viewer says, negative stories from Craig Gilbert and Jason Stein about Scott Walker and Donald Trump, and I challenge them to find something positive about Trump or Walker.
Well, on the Trump side, you have a potentially one of the gravest political scandals in the nation's history that is surrounding Trump. Not proven, but, it's out there. And you have no legislative victories that people can really point to. So, by that very nature of those two things, the coverage of Trump is going to be very tough. It would be anyway, but with those two things, it's very tough. I'll let you take Governor Walker.
Actually, just a couple of weeks ago, he was our winner here. His numbers are up. The Foxconn coverage is not, it's sometimes critical, but that would be a huge victory for him if he gets it.
I think he'd get a lot of credit for that.
If
they land it.
The fact is there's one bipartisan element to this question, and that is anybody who's in power believes that they're being covered too critically. For us, victory brings scrutiny, and so that's what the press does.
So, Dan, what's, from another viewer, what's the difference between what Donald Trump Jr. did, meeting with a Russian lawyer, and let's say the
Washington... Who says, who's purportedly has negative information from the
Russian... About Hillary Clinton.
Yeah.
And is purporting to represent the Russian government, compared with the Washington Post or the New York Times doing the same thing?
I think... I can't say for the New York Times or Washington Post. I've never had a foreign government come to me and say, or a representative of a foreign government or someone purporting to be. But, you know, with something like that, for me, the issue would be not just the information they're providing, but the fact that, that a foreign government was trying to influence the election. I think that for us, it could become the news story. Mm-hmm. It's not so much what they're bringing, but you would have to try to confirm that the person is associated with the foreign government. And then you would have to also see the government and whether it's allied or not allied with our government and what axe they have to grind. Because many of the people calling with tips have axes to grind. But the fact is, you know, that if a foreign government is trying to influence an election, that becomes a story in and of itself.
And there might be the difference. Other difference might be that the foreigners might be trying to influence the potential next president.
Right, right. Which is a huge difference between a newspaper and
a journalist and a politician.
I think you can't overstate a foreign government trying to influence an American election is unusual and, I would think, unacceptable.
I don't think it's... It probably is not.
It's happened in the past. And, In fact, Lyndon Johnson accused Nixon of colluding with a foreign government. In that case, I believe,
but the question is,
North Vietnam.
How directly did they do it, and were they successful? I mean, those become the other issues as well. And I'm sure America has tried to influence other elections. We know...
More than that.
Right. We know, a number of times that we've tried to do it, but... The politics involved here is another thing that Trump doesn't seem to appreciate. He did an interview yesterday with the 700 Club, and he said during the interview that is basically the Russians were promoting their interests and we're promoting our interests. What's the difference? Well, there's a huge difference between those two things. We've, you know, been enemies with Russia and the Soviet Union for, you know, nearly 100 years.
Not 100 years, but decades. And it's gone... back and forth. In recent years, I mean, there was the hope that there would be a rapprochement. And under Putin, it's gone the other way.
Okay. Well, that wraps up another version of On Politics. I want to thank Jason Stein, Mary Spacuzza, Ashley Lutheran, and my colleagues Dan Bice and Bill Glauber. Thanks for being with us.